Welcome again to KBOO, Grace Dillon.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on again.
Well, the last time you were on The Old Mole, you talked about your work as a consultant on the film Antlers and how you weighed in on the director's use of Indigenous imagery and storytelling. You're perhaps best known for coining the term Indigenous Futurisms, a literary film and arts movement that pays homage to Afrofuturism. In your introduction to the anthology, Walking the Clouds, you describe recurring themes and ways of thinking about Native history and worldviews and visions of the future in works associated with Indigenous futurisms. So let's start by talking about this term, what it encompasses and what it means.
Well, first of all, I really love John Reeder, a friend of mine and a professor at the University of Hawaii, who wrote about how genre fiction really isn't genre fiction, but that rather they are families of resemblances. And I've always really loved that expression, families of resemblances, because no matter how, like in Walking the Clouds, I went ahead and gave a few categories that were just emerging from what I was reading and from what the authors themselves were describing, because that was a huge part of that anthology, was to actually get their own input about what they thought science fiction meant, seeing themselves as Indigenous futurisms, what that meant to them. And so there's some really wonderful thinking going on with that. Indigenous futurisms, like Afrofuturism, African futurisms, Chicana Latina futurisms, or Latinx futurisms is the more recent terming, Gulf futurisms, Middle East, Israeli futurisms, Asian futurisms, all of those to me are indebted to Afrofuturism, and in particular, Alondra Nelson, who now works for President Joe Biden in an official capacity connected to health. But she was the one who edited in 2002 this amazing scholarly input from Africana scholars from all over, taking together what they had exchanged online, because it really started in online forums and discussions there. And then they created in Social Text the first edited collection of scholarship on Afrofuturism. And I was reading that just as I had become tenure track, thanks to the graciousness of Ursa K. Le Guin, who really mentored me, supported me, and wrote a letter for me to get a science fiction tenure track job at PSU. And at the time, I was, you know, reading all different kinds of science fiction, but was really struck by the hesitancy, actually, to bring in Indigenous writings into either the fantastic fields, the horror fields, or science fiction fields. And all of that, by the way, when it's combined, is really speculative literature, horror, fantasy, and science fiction. And at this point, it's become so experimented with that those strands of horror, SF, and the fantastic often can appear in the same story or novel.
SF meaning science fiction.
Yeah, that's the scholarly expression for it.
Yeah, right. Seems like part of a thread that runs through these traditions of oppressed peoples who are claiming a vision of the future is to break with a Eurocentric vision of modernity and heroic narratives, and where Africanness and Indigenousness is both kind of a backdrop to white, particularly white male stories, but also are associated with the past, sometimes a tragic past, but nonetheless the past. And you do talk about that in your introduction. This is not about only or primarily reclaiming a tragic history, but challenging even many of those constructions of Indigenousness. Can you speak to that, which is kind of a political dimension of it?
Well, first of all, just as we are in land claim acknowledgments that are starting to be seen around University communities all over and many different professional institutions. The important thing that sometimes is left out is our own presence, our own dynamic presence. And so for us, just as it is the case for many BIPOC communities and co-future communities, we ourselves are, and Gerald Visner, who's Anishinaabe like I am, termed it survivance. And it's both theory and process and method at the same time, as all of our theories are. And he suggests that we actually overgo tragedy, dominance, and victimry by celebrating through storytelling and natural reason. And natural reason is often connected to anything connected to being outside or what we call normal or outside, but in the English language is referred to as nature. And so within that natural reasoning and that storytelling, and by the way, I grew up with all of our stories about science. Anything that was science, I learned through stories of certain animals, animal persons, just all different kinds of trickster stories with sly wit. But in the process of that, learning the actual Gikindasawan or the everyday science that we live with, like tending and taking care of plants and things of that nature.
Well, yeah. One example I'd like you to maybe talk a bit about from Walking the Clouds in your introduction to the essay by Andrea Hairston, who, as you say, challenges us to examine our feelings about ghost phenomena, those uncanny presences that we occasionally feel but cannot rationally categorize. This is perhaps ghost phenomena associated more with horror than science fiction, but I think it was of interest to me because ghost stories really are about the dead haunting the living and bridging a history perhaps that's unsettling for the living. Can you say something about that example and how it's part of Indigenous futurisms, and particularly around this notion of how our understanding of history gets projected into visions of the future?
Yeah. What's interesting about ghost stories is, yes, they can be very haunting. They can feed you with fire. They can make you dance and metamorphose into animals, as happens in Andrea Hairston's novels. But I'm also thinking of, there's a lot of intermixing of ghosts or ancient spirits, so that you can go from Stephen Graham Jones, who's pagan Blackfeet, from his novel, The Fast Red Road, where there's a Indian country is set up for real as this huge, huge, huge territory that only natives can live in. Even anthropologists can't sneak in, although they try to. But in that case, there you have the looming, horrifying, taller than taller than taller, gigantic images of spirit ancestors that frighten everyone, right? And then you have in Sherman Alexie's story, he has a short story that is also in that collection. And he has ghosts there too, especially with ghost dancing. But he also manages to very wittily kind of undercut the figurehead for ghost dancing, who was actually an orphan that was raised by white people and was interviewed by an Irish journalist. So many, many, many forms of Indigenous futurisms have come out since 2012. And Darcy Little Badger, who is Lipan Apache Nation, a member of the Lipan Apache Nation, who is an assistant professor at the Seattle College just across the border there, has written, it's called A Ghost Story, A Lotsaway. but it is also Indigenous futurisms. And then her sequel, or a book that went beyond that, is called A Snake Falls to Earth. And that just came out. And what's interesting about those ghost stories is that, yes, some of them are scary and some of them are frightening, but some of them are not like that at all.
Some are sustaining and strengthening, like drawing on, yes, on spirits, like, yes, like the ghost dancing was part of a resistance in this region too, to colonization, as I understand that history. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And so those kind of ghost stories bring in the way we interact with our ancestors, with spirit beings, and with others. For us, Indigenous futurisms and all futurisms, including Afrofuturism, has this. Instead of the old cyberpunk falsification of body versus mind, and in post-cyberpunk writing, they've really kind of reacted to that and, you know, engaged in that a lot more. But where in cyberpunk, it was important to get away from your meat, away from your flesh, away from your skin, away from your body, and get into a mind that you could even just upload somewhere, right? And for futurisms, we have the complexity, the high context level of body, mind, spirit simultaneously. And so it's much like Sammy Schock, who is this excellent African-American and disabled scholar and artist who has written about disability studies as body, mind, and she makes it one word. And for us in our Routledge handbook, we're making one word, body, mind, spirit, to show that it is simultaneously all one and the same thing. And our sciences are the same way. We have Gregory Cajete, who is Pueblo and has written much about Indigenous sciences and Native science. And he talks about how our sciences, because it's not just one, our sciences are high context as opposed to low context. Because with Eurocentric uses of science, it's often low context because you're in a lab, you're splicing things apart, you're trying to bring it down to its smallest item and kind of toss out other things while you're doing that, right?
To maximize control, which often has the illusion of control of over the phenomena that's under the microscopic, yes, focus of science.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have to say, though, that worldwide, sciences are changing and Indigenous sciences are actually making it really big. And there have been some really wonderful texts, like one that just came out this late January, called Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. And that's by Jessica Hernandez. She got her PhD from University of Washington.
So some of this is breaking with certain dichotomous ways of thinking. Indigenous is associated with backwardness, westernness with future, the future and scientific thinking and technological, yeah, possibilities. So you're really challenging, or this field really challenges those dichotomies and reclaims and a kind of vision of progress in a way. What does progress mean in that sense?
Yeah. And so high context for us, as Gregory Cajete defines it in Indigenous Community, Rekindling the Teachings of the Seventh Fire, and he shows how our singing, dancing, ceremony, storytelling, music, drumming, all of that kind of thing is a part of our science. And so it's very much engaged with that. Now, the important thing is that we don't make it either Indigenous science or Eurocentric science. We view global scientific perspectives as all having value as you observe them and practice with them and work together. So there are tribal schools, for instance, that have nanobiotechnologies that they're working with, you know, where they're working both with organic and with nanobites at the same time.
So it would be a mistake to characterize indigenous sciences as a rejection of the Western history of scientific thinking.
That's right. I mean, there are parts of it where we are different, but there are more parts where we overlap. And so it's the overlap and it's the consensus building. And even when we get huge grants from the National Foundation of Science, we are often bringing together indigenous sciences with an overlap of allyship. Let's say we work with a lot of allies that are, like our dean, for instance, is a biologist.
At Portland State University.
Yes, and he's worked very strongly to bring in actual positions for teaching indigenous sciences in our program. Like, I think we have at least three that do that. And then I teach indigenous sciences through the storytelling of indigenous futurisms.
Grace Dillon, thank you for being with us today on the Olmol Variety Hour.
Thank you very much, Janice, for giving me the honor of being on this show with you.
Oh, well, thank you. And we will speak again.